And again, I'd like to welcome you to today's MSDN webcast, part one of ASP.NET 2.0, Fundamentals Using Visual Basic .NET. I'd like to introduce today's presenter, Fritz Onion. Fritz is a co-founder of Pluralsight, a .NET training firm that does courses all around the world. Fritz, it's all yours.
Thanks very much, Dave, and welcome all to today's webcast on ASP.NET 2.0 and DB.NET. As you mentioned, this is the first of a four-part series that we're conducting this week, so be sure to join us for the remaining three if you enjoy today. As you mentioned, I do work for Pluralsight. We do instructor-led training courses around the world, and if you want to check out more on us, the URL at the bottom of the screen is pluralsight.com/fritz is my blog. Here's the list of sessions that we're going to be giving this week. We actually just did one earlier today on C-sharp using this on the same topic, and the current session, as you see on the screen here, is the DB.NET version of that same topic. We'll have sessions in each of the next three proceeding days as well, and the times and dates are listed as you see there. Okay, so we have quite a bit to look at today. Let's go ahead and get started. The agenda for today, we're going to start off with a look at a sample application written in ASP.NET 2.0. And my goal here is to sort of give you a quick introduction to a number of features that are available in ASP.NET 2.0. Look at the full implementation. We'll open it up inside of Visual Studio and sort of start poking around and looking at various features. And this is a moderately complex application that's data-driven, backed up with a database, and should give you a reasonable impression of how to use a lot of these features of ASP.NET 2.0 to actually build real-world sites that are going to be hosted on the web. And the other purpose of looking at the sample application, which I will make available for download shortly after this presentation completes, is to introduce and motivate many of the features that we'll be looking at over the next several days in the subsequent sessions for this series, 2, 3, and 4. And with that sort of overall introduction, we're then going to drill down and look at a few specific details relating to the architecture of ASP.NET 2.0. We're going to talk about the class generation mechanism. So those of you that are new to ASP.NET in general, one of the first things you'll have to understand is how every single request comes into an ASPX page, which is then parsed into a class definition, compiled into an assembly, loaded into the worker process, and then used to service that request. So we're going to go through a few of those steps and make sure everyone's comfortable with how that works. We'll then talk about the code behind model, which is a mechanism in ASP.NET for separating out programmatic logic from the HTML markup layout that you might have on your page. And we'll also take a brief look at some of the page lifecycle and events that you need to be familiar with to make sure you're doing things at the right time as you interact with a page and build up your site. Okay, so that's the plan. Here's a quick screenshot of the site we're going to be looking at as a demonstration site. I'll walk through a live presentation of this in just a moment, but let me just briefly preview it. This is a movie review site. It has a database of a couple thousand movies in it, and then we also have a bunch of reviews for each of the movies. And the site is designed to let you easily look at all of the reviews for an associated movie, associated with the movie, also look at general collection of reviews that have just come out and a list of movies that are just coming out, that kind of thing. So you've probably seen something like this on the web in various forms. Anyway, we're going to take a look at this and look at how we've built it inside of ASP.NET 2.0. So the idea is to give you a relatively full-featured application with a reasonable look and feel, not just a bunch of blank white boxes, and show you how we're leveraging many of the features of ASP.NET 2.0 to build such an application. Now, just to familiarize you with the layout of the application before we go and jump into it, we're going to have a single top-level homepage here, and from that you can navigate to go look at all of the movies in the database and do some searching on the movies. You can look at all the reviews associated with a particular movie, and you can look at a particular review. So you can navigate from the reviews page over to the review singular page and look at the actual text of a review and the reviewer name, etc. And then there's also a form for submitting a review. So if you are looking at the reviews for a movie, you can actually click and say, let me add my own review to the collection of data in the site. Now, to keep this thing relatively easy to understand, the database schema for the sample application is quite straightforward. It's just a pair of tables, so it shouldn't stretch your SQL abilities, really. But the first one is a movies table. It contains a list of movies with their titles and release date and a primary key. And the second table is just a list of reviews with a foreign key reference back to the movie table, and then a review ID with a summary, a rating, a review name, and a reviewer, review content, and then reviewer name. So that's the setup for the sample application. And again, some of the points I'd like to make here is we're not going to really drill down into any specific feature at this point. I want to make sure you're just using this as a way to sort of look at and get a feel for what's possible in ASP.NET. And I am going to highlight various features that we're going to be talking about in more detail in the next couple of sessions. So keep that in mind as we go through this. Right? Don't get too hung up on any particular detail, but just let it give you the impression that we're looking at. Okay, so we're going to go do a sharing demonstration and point out a number of the features, again, that leverage these 2.0 ASP.NET 2.0 features, including things like master pages and themes and et cetera. So I'm going to go into sharing mode at this point. If you'd like to maximize the viewing area on your screen, you can hit F5 to do so, and that will get rid of some of the extraneous toolbars and hopefully make it easier to see the live demonstration. And what I'm going to do now is bring up Visual Studio 2005, and I already have this project loaded, which is what you're seeing here. And again, this project is it consists of those five pages we talked about, as well as a couple of controls, a little bit of helper code, among other things. And we're just going to walk through a few of the pieces here and give you a feel for how this is all put together and something to go back and look at yourself once the session is over. So I'm going to start by running this. Now, if I had deployed this to a server hosting with IIS, I could actually just access it through a browser talking directly to IIS, even over the network, obviously. To keep things simple for the session, I'm going to run all of our sites using the ASP.NET development server, which is integrated into Visual Studio 2005. This makes it quite easy to run a sample application without having to configure IIS and set up the virtual directory and application and all of that. So we'll stick with this for now. Be aware that we will have a later session on how to deploy to IIS and some of the considerations there. So we'll do this for our development, and then when we talk about deployment, we'll take a look at some of the decisions you have to make as you push things out. So to run this with minimal overhead, I'm going to run it using the debug start without debugging and just launch it on the front page here and give you a quick feel for what this site has involved. So I described it briefly, but let me just show it to you in action here. So notice the front page has a menu across the top, and I can actually drill into any of these pages if I wanted to. On the left-hand side, we have a couple of panels. One shows some recent releases, and these should be reasonably up to date. So recent releases that have come out based on the date in the table in the database, and then a list of upcoming releases that are not yet out but scheduled to be. And then on the main page, in the main portion of the main page, we have a list of the latest reviews that have been posted to our database. So the idea would be if someone just added a new review, it would be listed among the 16 or so that are shown by default on the front page and be easy to identify something new that showed up on the site. Okay, so let's drill in here. Once you see a movie, perhaps, that you want to look at in more detail, so let's go look at the reviews for the producers. I can click on the link over there, and it brings me to the review page there, where it lists only the reviews for that particular film. And then I can drill into a particular review, and notice that I can see the content of the review, the actual text, the name of the reviewer, the rating, the summary, and the title, and all of that is laid out. A couple things to note about the rest of the user interface that's taking place here while I interact with the site. If you see in the upper right-hand corner, I have a breadcrumbs implementation, which is just a way of tracking where you are in the navigational structure of the site, and we'll talk about the control that does that for us in a bit. So I could easily click back to where I'd been before, very common feature to see in a website. And then the menu itself, you can, of course, drill into, say, the movies page, and that will take us to the page consisting listing all of the movies in the database. Notice we have pagination built into the display, the tabular display for all the movies. We also have sorting capabilities. You can sort based on release date, on the rating, on the title, and you can also do a search. So I can look for all movies that have the word star in them, and that will reduce the result set to this subset of films that are stored in the database. Okay, so that's kind of a quick walkthrough. Oh, one more thing I want to show you, the submit form. So I actually go to a film, and there I should find a hyperlink at the top left which says submit a review, which would bring you to the form for submitting reviews for a particular film. So this is you can fill out your own contribution here, give it some sort of rating. I've kept it very loosely typed, so we didn't have drop-downs and such to keep it simple. But in general, it lets you input all you need to input to show add a new entry for a review. Okay, so there's my review listed right there. Okay, so let's go back and take a look at a few of the pieces that are used to construct this site. And specifically, what I want to do is highlight some of the ASP.NET 2.0 features that we're going to be talking about in the next week, and sort of motivate, you know, where you tend to use these things and why you use them in general. The first thing I want to show you is the master page. This is a really useful productivity feature that has been introduced in ASP.NET 2.0, and it essentially lets you define a top-level template for any number of pages in your site. So a very common thing you'll tend to want to do in a web application is have a common header and maybe a footer and a navigation bar on the side, perhaps. So much like that movie site had, we didn't really change much in the surrounding display, but we changed the inner content based on what page we were navigating to. And the way we achieved that was by writing a master page. So you see this page up here is called site-template.master, and it's got a master directive at the top. And then it's got a bunch of layout, including the HTML and form elements. And down here we have some tables, and we have some, there's a menu control, among other things. And this master page, with all of its layout and styles, is then applied to individual pages. So if you go back to the Solution Explorer here and open up one of our pages, let's say default.aspx, you'll notice that in the page directive at the top here, I have a reference to the master page file, which is referring to that site-template.master page. And all of the contents inside of this content control are going to be injected into the master page at a specific location that you designate. Okay, so we're going to walk through all the details of using master pages later in another session, but I just want to, you know, briefly point that out. That's how we're building the template-based user interface that you see in this site. Another feature related to the user interface of the site is the theme. This application has defined an application theme, which is a directory under the app themes directory. And the theme, in our case, consists of two files. One is a skin file, which is a bunch of control declarations with some default properties. So basically, if you apply this theme to a page on your site, for example, every text box on that page will implicitly have its background color set to the value you see here, and its border style set to solid, et cetera, et cetera. So these are default attributes that can be applied to server-side controls in ASP.NET, and if you subscribe a page to a theme, it will apply those styles. So it's a nice way of centralizing those user interface decisions into a single location without having to spread them across your site and then making modifications difficult later on. Also inside of this theme is a style sheet, a standard style sheet. This is implicitly linked to by every page that subscribes to that theme. And this is standard CSS that you've probably used before, and it's brought in like any other CSS file might be to a page. Now finally, the way we've linked everything up in this site is we've subscribed all of our pages to one theme so that we can control them from one location. And the way we've done that here is if you look in the web.config file, you'll see a pages element with a theme attribute set to movies. And that's what hooks it all up. So every page in the site, by default, will have a movies theme applied to it because of this configuration setting. Okay, so let's look at a couple other features here. One of the most useful features in ASP.NET in general is the ability to create reusable components. And this site has an example of a reusable component called a user control, which you see under the controls directory here, called recent and upcoming. This is an example of user controls. The extension is .ascx, and this thing is basically just a chunk of HTML and server-side controls and logic, perhaps, that's going to be dropped into some other page. And the advantage of isolating it into a single control is that you can very easily reuse this across multiple pages in your site and then have a single source of to make any changes that are reflected across the site. Now, this particular control is used inside of the master page on the left-hand side to show the recent and upcoming film releases, if you recall that in the user interface. And if you go open up the master page, we scroll down a little bit, you should actually see an instance of that control. Let me scroll up first, actually. Here's the reference to the control file itself at the top, the register directive. It's got a reference to the recent and upcoming .ascx file. That's a standard control reference in ASP.NET. And then further down, we should see a tag UC1 colon recent and upcoming where the control is actually being used. And there it is. Okay, so right down here inside of our master page, so that every page receives it, we have the recent and upcoming control dropped into that left-hand pane, as you saw in the UI. Okay, so encapsulation and reuse is a big theme in ASP.NET 2.0, as in addition to 1.1. Another thing you'll notice as you sort of poke around in this sample application is there's relatively little DB.NET code. Right, a lot of these pages don't consist of any code at all. They simply are a bunch of declarative tags in markup. And the primary reason for this is the use of the declarative data source controls that we'll talk a bit more about today and then quite a bit more about later. Data source controls give you the ability to encapsulate a data query, whether it be a stored procedure call or a direct SQL call or a data access layer invocation. And you can then associate that collection of data with a control. So in the example I have here, I have a details view, and I've associated this control, this data source control, using its identifier, which if I scroll to the right, you can see. Whoops. Oh, sorry, right here. So the identifier of the data source control is review data source, and I've set the data source ID of the details view to be equal to that. And that's simply saying, look, when this guy needs data, he's going to go ask this control for that data, whether it means retrieving it or updating or deleting. In this case, it's only retrieving, but they're set up to do all of the above. Okay, this is an interesting control here, too. Again, we'll talk more about these in detail later, but a details view lets you show one row at a time on a form. We also have a control called a grid view, which we can see in the movies page. Grid view is used to show a complete tabular rendering of a result set. So this is bound to a multi-row collection of data that is then going to be displayed in some tabular format, as you saw in the main form. And then there's one other data-bound control that's useful to take a look at in the submit review page. You'll see a form view. This is very much like a details view. It shows you one row at a time, but it's completely templatized, which means that you define exactly what controls are going to be used and displayed to display the contents of the row. Okay, it's a bit more flexible in its implementation, specifically useful for things like doing updating where you might want to add validation and other types of input control. All right, a couple last things here, and then we're going to go back and talk about some architecture details. One thing I did want to point out is this web.sitemap file. So I showed you two navigation features on the site in that initial demo. One was the breadcrumbs in the upper right-hand corner, and the other was the menu that lets you actually click on a particular page to navigate there. All of that information for those two controls was driven from this XML file called web.sitemap. And this contains a standard schema that's used to describe the navigational structure of your site. You can create arbitrary nestings of these elements depending on how your site is structured. And there doesn't necessarily have to be a physical correspondence in terms of directory structure, but it's more navigation structure. Anyway, once you do that, you can then use controls like the menu control. So if I scroll over to my master page and look up here, well, here's another example of a control that uses it. This is the breadcrumbs control, or the sitemap path control, it's a more formal name. And this guy will tap into the sitemap file that I just showed you and use the XML information to to set up that breadcrumbs implementation so that you can easily click back to a page that you've been to before. And then finally, the menu control should be up here somewhere near the top. And there it is. So there's a server-side menu control, and that's mapping to a data source control that is also tied to the same XML file. Okay, so again, just to give you sort of an impression of some of these features, we have the navigational structure defined in an XML file. We have these controls that tap into it. And with just a few layout, dropping a few controls on, you can very easily add navigational features to your site without much difficulty. The last thing I want to point out is there's a new directory, if you're not familiar with ASP.NET 2.0, called AppCode. And this directory is used specifically for hosting classes that you want to be able to reference in your site. Now, ASP.NET 2.0 still supports the concept of compiling code into an assembly and deploying that in the bin directory, which you may want to do. But this is a bit more convenient in many cases. If you just want to write a class and drop it into your application and make sure that it's available for the rest of your site, here's an easy way to do it. You drop it into AppCode. ASP.NET will implicitly compile any classes there and add a reference to the generated assembly to every page that you have in your site. So in this case, I have a little utility class that I've written, which has the ability or implements a function called truncateString and another one for retrieving the little thumb URL that you saw on the site. So a very common thing to do in this directory is just to write utility classes, perhaps a data access layer, business logic layer, that kind of thing, something that is specific to the site, local, but is in the form of code that you want to integrate with the rest of the application. Okay, so that's a whirlwind tour of a little sample application. Like I said, I'm going to make that application available for download immediately after this session is completed, and I'll just write down the URL for you at the completion of the session. Okay, so switching modes now, we're going to go take a look at some of the architectural features or how ASP.NET is built and how you work with it. And what I'd like to do in the next several slides is sort of work through all the way from writing an ASPX file into compiling that into a class in general, and how do you use these features of ASP.NET 2.0 sort of from the ground up. So, to begin with, if you're not familiar with ASP.NET yet, it's important to note that this entire architecture is built on top of .NET, as the name implies. But what's important about that is that every single page, every page you write, right, so every ASPX page, is actually turned into a class. So this is one of those sort of conceptual things you need to get under your skin before you really start working in ASP.NET. It's different from many other environments in the sense that everything in your page is turned into part of a class definition. And everything you add to the page is also included in part of that class definition. So you're essentially writing a new class every time you write a new page. These classes, once they're generated, are then compiled into assemblies. That's the binary format for .NET, the DLL file. And those assemblies are then loaded into the ASP.NET worker process in a dedicated application domain for your virtual directory. And then they're used to process requests. So they create instances of your classes, they call the special process request method on it, and that proceeds through all the code that you've written plus any code that ASP.NET has decorated the class with based on the markup. The worker process itself, if you want to go looking for it, is going to be either ASP.NET_WP.exe if you're running XP or Server 2000, or it's going to be W3WP.exe if you're running Server 2003, which probably most real live deployed sites are going to be doing today. That's using IIS 6. And then classes are created on demand. So the way you work with ASP.NET, the simple way to look at it is you just write ASPX files. But conceptually what's happening is you're actually building additional classes, even if you're not physically writing the class, but your pages are turning into them. And you're extending base classes and you're controlling the class generation process from ASPX. Okay, so we're going to look at that in a bit more detail in just a moment. One other sort of piece of infrastructure to get out of the way, make sure everyone understands, is that ASP.NET is layered on top of IIS today. Now, this layering is actually going to become much more integrated with the next release of IIS in IIS 7, which won't be out for a bit. But today in IIS 6 or IIS 5, depending on which platform you're running on, ASP.NET is integrated through IIS using an ISAPI filter and an ISAPI extension. This is the standard hooking mechanism in IIS. And what they've done is associated the ASPX extension, .ASPX, with a dedicated ISAPI DLL that knows how to hand the request over to the worker process that has been started up for ASP.NET. So most of the time, this will be transparent to you. You'll just host your site. You'll set up the virtual directory in IIS and put your pages and your code in there, and it's off and running. But it's good to be aware, if anything goes wrong, that this mechanism has to be in place, right? You have to have that ISAPI extension associated with all of your ASP.NET extensions. If you ever find this is broken, by the way, there's a nice utility, command line utility called ASP.NET regiis, _regiis, which you can run to restore all of these script map entries to make sure ASP.NET is installed correctly. Okay, so let's move on to actually writing pages. Now, what I thought I would do here today is start off with a sample content page that has some dynamic content, hopefully, you know, relatively straightforward for most of you. Whether you're coming from an ASP background, or if you've done some ASP.NET, or perhaps you're coming from PHP, all of them have similar concepts of, you know, having some static HTML that you want to integrate with some dynamic server-side code. And traditionally in ASP.NET, and ASP for that matter, the way you've done this is you've used these various forms of markup to write pieces of server-side code, which you then integrate into the HTML on the page that you want to have rendered to the client. So I'm going to switch out to a view sharing session again here and open this sample that I have prepared and then sort of work through some of the issues with it. So let's go ahead and switch to sharing mode. Again, if you want to see the whole desktop, you might hit F5 at this point. And what I'm going to do is open up the sample architecture website that I have here. This is a much simpler website. It's just a few pages. If you're used to working in Visual Studio 2003, by the way, one of the nice things you'll notice in 2005 is they've gotten rid of the web project mechanism. So by default now, opening a website is as simple as just pointing Visual Studio to a directory if you want to. It still supports going through localhost and IIS if you want to with all these other settings. But if you just want to open up a site and do some testing, this is a really quick way to do it, easy, always works. You don't even have to have IIS installed. So a lot of nice aspects to working with a simplified model. Okay, so here's that sample page that I was just describing in the slides. We're using VB.NET, and I've got some server-side code up here. Just like any ASP.NET page, I have a page directive at the top describing the language preference, and you can also put other attributes that we'll look at later. And then I have a couple examples of server-side code. So first of all, I've written a couple of functions, or one function rather, and I've declared a constant local variable, and I put these inside of a script with a run at server attribute, and that makes sure that all the elements inside of here are actually going to be added to the class that is generated for this page. So any stuff you put in here, any code, any variable declarations, any property values, property declarations, are going to be added directly to the class definition. So these must be class-level constructs that you place at this location. And I've written a function called getDisplayItem that takes an integer value and returns a constructed string based on that integer. And then down here, you can see that I have some standard HTML. I've got a form with run at server on it. And I also have some interspersed script. So this is sort of the classic ASP style, where you would just drop in some server-side code using this less than percent sign syntax and put the code in. And this will then be applied directly, evaluated in the context of the page. Now, in ASP.NET, this actually isn't run through a script engine like it was in ASP, but rather it's turned into a function. This whole thing, all of the static content here plus the dynamic content, is actually turned into a function that's added to the class associated with this page that ASP.NET creates. Okay, so the two syntaxes you should be aware of is this syntax, the standard server-side code syntax, and the evaluation syntax, which is the same but with an equal sign, which simply says take the result of this and drop it into the response.write buffer. So if I run this page, all of this should be evaluated on the server, and all we should see in the client is an unordered list of items defined by whatever this thing, this function up here returns for each integral value that we pass in. In this case, we're going from 0 to 9. So, and then down here we print out the whole thing. So let's try running this. I'm just run without debugging again to reduce the overhead. And we see our browser come up. And notice we're in the hosted development server, so it's actually not going through IIS. It's a local server only, and it's on some random port they set up, 2479 in this case. But there you go. So there's my page, dynamic content, based on the markup that I put in the page. And again, this whole thing was generated from a class definition that was created. Now, what I want to start doing is shifting this more into an ASP.NET development mindset. So right now, this feels very ASP-like. The markup is in the page, the code is sort of scattered about, and in most of the time you're going to really want to strive for a separation of your programmatic interaction and the actual display of the page. So as a first step, I'm going to go ahead and switch this around to using server-side controls in ASP.NET. And in this case, since I'm trying to render a list, unordered HTML list, I'm going to use the server-side control bulleted list. Actually, a new control in ASP.NET 2.0, but it's a pretty simple one. And I'm going to pre-populate this with a couple of items, just so that if I looked at it in the designer, it would show up with some content, and not just an empty box. Although this will not necessarily reflect what's actually going to be there at runtime, but it's usually a good idea to populate your controls that are going to be dynamically rendered with some representative static data, so it shows up okay in the designer. And then what I'm going to do is hook an event in the page class. Well, actually, before I do any of this, let me save this off as version 2 so that you guys can see the progression when you go back and look at the demos. By the way, I will have all of these demos available for download shortly after we finish the session today. Okay, so I'm going to hook into the load event of the page. Very common thing to do in ASP.NET, just add a handler for the load event so that you can intercept the page before it goes to rendering and after all the controls are created. This case, I'm going to use the overrides keyword in VB.NET to override the onload function. That's actually a virtual function inside of the page base class that we're inheriting from. And what I can now do is access this identifier, the bulleted list. So let me give this guy an ID that I can refer to. Let's call it display list. And then up here, I'm going to access it. So let's do the following. For I as integer equals 0 to the display count, item count, minus 1, we're going to add a new list item. So one of the advantages, as soon as you switch over from this markup syntax like I was using into a server-side control model, is that you're no longer just sort of interspersing content, but now we're actually programming against an object model. So there is this entity called the bulleted list that has it's defined by a class. And this particular instance of it is represented by the variable underscore display list, which is going to be added as a member variable to my class. So I can actually go into my code inside of the load event handler for my page, and I can access the display list like so, and I can access its list of items programmatically, and I could add a new one. Right? So I could say, let's create a new list item, like so, and let's use the constructor that takes a string, and I'm going to figure out what the string is by calling my helper function there, getDisplayName, getDisplayItem rather, with the integral value for I at this location. Now, one thing to keep in mind here, if you are doing this programmatically, is that I added those static items. Before I put new ones in, I should clean those out if I don't want them. So before I do any of this, I'm going to say displayList.items.clear. And that'll get rid of anything that's in there already. And we'll leave the rest of that down here. So this is now programmatically populating the server-side control bulleted list with the same dynamic function, the server-side function getDisplayItem that I was using before. But notice my page is now quite a bit cleaner. In fact, I can just get rid of all of that interspersed server-side script that I had before. Now, if this shows exactly what it showed before, we'll know that everything worked properly. And so let's go ahead and try running this without debugging. And it's looking good. Okay, so there's the same page. Couldn't really tell the difference from the client. But in the server, we've managed to sort of isolate things into code and markup. And this is just a trend that we're going to start we're going to push even further, right? We're going to start moving code all the way out to a different file and really treating these things as separate entities and creating a nice partitioning between the logic in your system and the layout. Okay, so let me catch up on a couple slides here. So what I just showed you was an example of using a server-side control, which gave me an object on the server that I could interact with, and that was an alternative to using that interspersed server-side script, which tends to, if you use it over time, it tends to build up into sites that are difficult to maintain and debug and sort of understand. So ideally, if someone is familiar with classes and objects, then the approach I just showed you is a bit more intuitive and easier to sort of manage in many respects. So anyway, any element that's marked with run at server in ASP.NET, it gives you an object model in the server to interact with the control, and it's going to take care of rendering its contents to the client at the right time. You can programmatically interact with it, and also by default, most of the controls in ASP.NET will implicitly keep their state across post requests. So if you're building a form where you're collecting data, and you're posting back and forth to the same form, all the controls on the form will actually keep their state around, so it gives you a nice continuity for interacting with a client without having to leverage things like session state. Okay, but let's take this one step further, and the next step is, notice in the code here, just like in the sample I just showed you, I was programmatically populating this control by going through my list of items and adding a new list item for each entry. What I want to do now is go back and show you how we can sort of take care of that implicitly through data binding. So again, switching to sharing mode, application sharing. I'm going to save this off one more time, or yet again. All right, so there's number 3. And let me just get rid of this guy down here. We could deal with this in other ways, but just in the interest of time, we'll clean it out. And what I want to do now is, instead of writing all this code by hand here, I want to have that happen implicitly by binding a control using data binding, which is essentially what we're doing, right? We're grabbing a collection of items, and we're explicitly sticking each item in based on how many items we got back from some method call. Now, to do this and keep things simple, I have a little array declaration that I'm going to use. So apologize for the flicker here. Let me just get it set up and you can take a look. Okay, so I have a local declaration of a string array, which I'm simply initializing to all the strings that I want to show up in my control. Keep in mind that this is completely dynamic and we're on the server, so you could be grabbing this data from absolutely anywhere. I'm just keeping it as a local collection of strings to make it simple and easy to run. But you could easily be reaching out to a database or calling into some class or invoking a web method across the internet, whatever you need to do. Let me get rid of these two guys now, since that's now implicit in my array. And finally, I'm going to rewrite this. Okay, so instead of programmatically populating this thing, I'm going to explicitly bind my control to the collection of data that is the local array in my page. So I'm going to grab my display list, and I'm going to access the data source property on it. You can assign this to any enumerable collection of data. And I'm going to assign it to my local display item data. And then I'm going to bind it. So once you have the association set up, you can call data bind, like so. And that will cause the control to go out and retrieve the data. For each item, it'll inject a new element inside of its collection based on the value of the item in the collection. And we should have a full display, just like we did before, without actually having to go in and programmatically put these things in. Okay, so essentially equivalent, but this is giving us a level of indirection and sort of taking away the details of having to manage that interaction with the control. So here's the site running again, and again, things look pretty much the same. I guess my numbers are off by one, but that was just a matter of choice. So everything looks pretty much the same, and the control this time did the binding. I didn't have to worry about it. Notice that by default this time, the static items were replaced with the dynamically data-bound items, which is the default behavior. You can change if you want to. Okay, let's take one more step here, and then we'll go back and look at the slides. The last step is to actually shift into a new model of data binding that was introduced in ASP.NET 2.0. And this model is called declarative data binding, and essentially it gives you a control that's capable of retrieving data and then supplying that data to another control. So in our scenario, what we're going to do is introduce another data control, or a data source control, and we're going to affiliate it with this bulleted list. So let me show you this technique and save this off one more time. So we're going to save this as 4. And this one's going to use declarative data binding, which is a new feature in ASP.NET 2.0. So before we jump in here, I'm going to add a class. So for declarative data binding, you need to have a class that returns a collection for you. So the simplest way to do this would be to add a class in our app code directory. Notice I don't have one in this project yet, so you can always go to your solution and add a special ASP.NET folder. There's nothing special about these folders besides their name, so you're welcome to create these folders yourself by hand on the hard disk, however you like, but this little utility makes it simple to do. And then I can add a new file inside of here, which is going to be a VB.NET class that I want to leverage in the rest of my application. So let's just call this my data source, like so. And I should have a new class ready to go inside of the app code directory. Okay, so there's my VB file under the app code directory inside of my site. And here's my class definition, which I also have prepared here. So let me drop that in. So I'm actually putting this class into a namespace, very common practice you probably want to follow as well. And I'm going to name the class my data source, and I'm going to give it a shared array of strings, just like the one I had before. And I'm going to expose a shared function called getItems, which my data source control is going to use to return the data. Okay, so let's go update our page to use this now. So to bridge the gap between this control and that data source class that I just showed you, I'm going to add an instance of the object data source, which is capable of pointing to any arbitrary type, any class you might have defined in your site or in the global assembly, to return the data, and it's then going to hook these two up. Right? So I'm going to tell the object data source, or I'm going to tell the bulleted list, go get your data from this object data source. It's been prepared to go find the data. So I'm going to specify type name, and this is going to be namespace msdn dot my data source. And then we're also going to specify the select method, which is what function on that class do you want me to call, which I've already forgotten. Let me check again. So getItems is the name of the function. And let's set the ID of this guy equal to items. Data source. Okay. Now there are designers to do all this stuff as well. I'm trying to keep things very focused and simple here. So just be aware that what we're doing is all possible with the mouse and dragging and dropping. But I like to keep things simple and focused. Okay. So here we go. I'm going to set the data source ID equal to the identifier of the object data source that I just created. So this guy right here. And that's how you set up that affiliation. And that's pretty much it. Okay, so now this guy knows how to go call that class to retrieve the collection of items. This guy has his data source ID set to the identifier of this data source control. And at runtime, the bulleted list will populate itself with that data at the right point in the lifetime of the page, so that by the time you get to rendering back to the client, it should have created all of those child list items as we did before by hand. So I can now get rid of a lot of this code up here. In fact, all of it, right? Because it's now all declarative, so we get rid of that code. Our code is now isolated over in the app code directory inside of this data source class that I've written, and we have a nice, very separated disjoint relationship between these two. So let's try running this guy. Hopefully we don't see any changes in the runtime behavior. And we don't. All right, looks good. So that all happened implicitly because of the declarative data source declaration and the association of that data source control with our bulleted list control. So it was all sort of self-contained. And this, by the way, is the mechanism that's used throughout that movie review site. So you're not constrained to just simple retrieval. You can actually do updates and deletes and inserts and et cetera against a full back-end database, either stored procedures or a data access layer or what have you. So it's a very flexible model, and it really goes a long way towards separating the data access code in your site from the actual presentation layer. Okay, so here are the slides we just walked through. This was the explicit data binding, where I had a local collection of items that I bound in my code by setting the data source programmatically and then invoking the data bind method, very common thing to do inside of the load event handler. And then the declarative data binding was the last sample we just worked through, where we created a separate class entirely and had it return a collection of items in the form of an array. Now, keep in mind, this is very generic. You don't have to return an array. This, you could return anything that's enumerable in .NET, which includes all of the collection classes, lists, hash tables, data tables in the database layer, data sets, if you're using those, data readers. All of the, those things are implicitly enumerable and would work fine for binding against the object data source. Okay, so that's kind of the progression of writing code in ASP.NET. Now, there are a couple other things I want to touch on today. First of all, I want to talk a little bit about CodeBehind for a couple reasons. One is it's going to give us yet another mechanism for separating out code from presentation. Now, the one I showed you was our page happened to be all about data binding, so that was a natural case for simply using a declarative data source to avoid having to clutter the page with code. But there are certainly occasions where you're still going to be writing code behind the page to sort of back up your logic, either implementing navigation logic or what have you. So anyway, ASP.NET has this nice feature called CodeBehind, which also lets you associate a class with a page in your site. So you don't have to put the code directly on the page at all, like we did initially. You can put it into a separate file completely and then just create the association. Now, this has been around since the beginning of ASP.NET, all the way back to 1.0. We're at 2.0 today. The 1.0 and 1.1 model is a little bit different than the model they're using in 2.0 today, although 2.0 supports all of the models. The earlier models used the inherits attribute to specify your alternative base class for the page. And then you typically compiled your code and deployed it in an assembly in the bin directory and then referred to it with the inherits keyword in the page. You could also use the source attribute. So you could either precompile it and deploy it in the bin, or you could use the source attribute and have ASP.NET compile it on the fly. Here's an example of ASP.NET 1.1 code behind, and I have an example in the demo that you can download and try it out. But in this example, I want to focus more on 2.0. Let me just briefly go over the syntax here, because you might run into it as you start working in ASP.NET. First of all, here's the inherits keyword in the page directive. Notice that the inherits keyword must reference a class that is associated with this file, and it must be have the full namespace scope, and the class you're referencing must derive from the page base class, which is system.web.ui.page. Okay, so that's the association here, and then this page is going to act as a base class for the class that ASP.NET generates when it parses this file. One other subtlety in 1.1 and 1.0 is you had to put member variable declarations in your class, in your code behind, so you could reference them, so we can sort of reach into them and modify their contents like we did initially. 2.0 gets rid of that and makes it a bit simpler to work with. So with that, let's go off to view sharing one more time, and let me show you code behind in ASP.NET 2.0 and how that's going to work. To do this, let me go ahead and just add a new web form to our site and show you what is generated. So in this case, we're going to use the wizard to generate a web form. I'll use the default name of default.aspx because I don't have one of those yet. And notice the checkbox here, place code in separate file. That's the checkbox that's asking you, do you want to use code behind when you write this class, or do you want to just put all the code directly into the page, or perhaps you don't have any code at all. So anyway, let's do it with code behind, and let me show you what it generated. So first of all, here's the default.aspx file. Notice that it generated a page with two extra attributes. One is code file. That's the new keyword in 2.0 that says I want to use the 2.0 version of CodeBehind, and here's the file that contains my class definition. And secondly, we still use the same inherits keyword So you are actually writing a base class in this file, and you simply must specify the name of the base class from which this page is going to inherit. Now, to look at the code that it has generated, if you go back to the Explorer here, notice my page default.aspx is expandable because there's an affiliated code behind file with it, and I can reach into this file, open up the source code for it, and there's my class definition. Okay, so this is where you would add your programmatic logic, where you would add a handler for the load event or whatever you want to do. Let me go ahead and add a handler for the load event. Let me just drop down the events on the page here and click on the load event to add the handler. Okay, so there's my page underscore load event. And now let me go to my back to my default.aspx and just add something that we can try out. So let's throw in another bulleted list here since that's what we've been using. Run it equals server, ID equals test list, and we'll just throw some stuff in it from the code behind. Okay. So there's my bulleted list declaration. Now in my code behind class, I will have an implicit reference to this variable. In 1.1, you had to add that explicitly or let the designer do it for you. In 2.0, if you noticed in my code behind file, your class that you write is actually something called a partial class, which means that this is not the full definition of this class. There's another piece to it. And the other piece is the piece that ASP.NET is going to generate for you. And it will have the member variable declarations for all of the server-side controls that you have laid out on that page. The end result of this is you don't even have to have those controls declared here, but they will be part of you, and the designer knows that. So you can come in here and simply say, test list. There it is. So test list dot items dot add, and let's just add new list item. Hi there. So all that stuff we were doing before, you could do equally easily here. But notice that all of our code is now in this nice separate file, which is associated with the other class. Now again, you are actually acting as the base class. So the class you're writing inherits from page. And then the class that ASP.NET parses this file into is going to derive from you. And you, in turn, are going to be merged before you actually get compiled with another partial class that ASP.NET creates that's going to have the member variable declarations. So in practice, what this ends up meaning is whenever you add a file to your a web form to your project with an associated code behind file, is you can sprinkle in as many server-side controls as you want here, and then you can go into your code behind file and add all the logic you need to your page and interact with the object definitions of all of those controls without having to do anything special, right? It'll just work. So nice separation. The object model works well, and you don't really have to do anything special to get it working. Okay, so there's my bulleted list with one item. Okay, let's go back and finish up. So here's the 2.0 code behind. As I mentioned, we have the code file attribute that's new in 2.0, and that means you're using the partial class mechanism, and you assume that ASP.NET is going to be generating the sibling class for you that contains all of the member variable declarations, among other things. Here's the classes that are generated, just for your reference. So the classes in blue here are the ones that ASP.NET creates, and the yellow one is your code behind class that you create. So this is your partial class with your event handlers and all that stuff. Here's the partial class that ASP.NET creates for you that contains the control variable declarations. And here's the class that ASP.NET generates when it parses your ASPX file and inherits from the unified base class that, that these two partial classes turn into. So that's the new model. Okay, a couple last things to touch on. One is, as you start working in ASP.NET, one of the first things you'll find is that you need to integrate into the page lifecycle. Right? Anytime you're writing code in an ASPX page, it's important to remember that every single request that comes into that page is going to get a fresh new instance of that class, and it's going to start off at the beginning, go through a series of events, ending with the rendering back to the client. And you, as the developer, have the opportunity to trap any subset of these events to alter that rendering. That's the way to think about this. In the examples that I've shown you so far, the event that I trapped was the load event, a very common event to work with in ASP.NET. And I used that to populate some of the server-side control contents so that when they got to the rendering portion, they were filled with the content that I wanted them to send back as the response to this request. So you can expose these events are exposed, and you can interact with them at various points. As I mentioned, there are a number of them. And as you're working in ASP.NET, you want to keep sort of this picture in mind right here on this slide, which shows you all of the events in the sequence that they will be applied or they will be triggered as you interact with the page or as a request is processed for a given page. I have annotated all of the 2.0 specific events, that is those that are unique to ASP.NET 2.0 with a little red indicator on the top right. All of the rest of them are both in 1.1 and 2.0. So the first event in 2.0 is the pre-init event. So you can use this to do any early initialization in your page. One of the things that this event is specifically useful for is for altering things like themes or master pages associated with a page, because by the time you get to init, which is the next event, that's already happened. So keep that in mind in 2.0, and we'll talk more about that in another session. After init, we have another init complete event in 2.0. 2.0 basically added several new events that give you more granularity into the event lifecycle of the page. So you just have more opportunity to find the exact right location to put your code into the class. Then we have the control creation during postback. Preload is a new event as well. Then load, that's the one you saw me handle, and probably by far the most common event to handle on a page class. Then if you have any buttons or other server-side controls that generate events on the server, that's where those get triggered. So if you had a button click event fired, that would fire right after load. Then there's a new load complete event in 2.0. So that fires after the events have fired. If it's an initial GET request, this is where the other controls are created, the child controls. Then we have pre-render, pre-render complete. You save some of the view state. And finally, render is the important one. That's where it takes all the controls and has them write their contents into the response buffer and it gets sent back to the client. And then the last event of interest is the unload, if you want to do any cleanup before your page actually is no longer referenced and ultimately reclaimed by the garbage collector. Okay, now a couple other things specifically about the events, how to subscribe to them is important to know. The syntax that I showed you initially was to use the virtual function override, and you can certainly do this. You can override a virtual function corresponding to that event in the base class, and the syntax looks like this right here, the protected override sub. If you're using visualstudio.net, I don't know if you noticed in the code that was generated for me there, it uses in DB.NET this syntax right here, which is to say it adds a handles keyword at the end of the function and describes the event that this method is a handler for. And that's a VB.NET specific syntax for subscribing a method to an event. And in this case, we're subscribing it to the page class, which we are a derivative of, so you just say me.load, or you could just say load. So that's the load event. That's the way you probably see it most often. I'd just like to point out the other ways in case you run across these. They all turn into the same thing in the end, so it doesn't really matter. This is a way of setting up a delegate subscription explicitly. That is, you can use the add handler keyword in VB.NET, give it the name of the event and the address of the function you want to subscribe to the event, and that will be called at the when the event is fired. And then finally, there's also a way in ASP.NET, if you specify auto event wire up to true on a page, you can actually just write a function that's named page_load, and that implicitly, during the ASP.NET initialization, it will be subscribed as a handler for that event. So this is actually the mechanism used by default in C# in 2005, whereas VB.NET uses this. So just be aware of all those techniques. Be most familiar with this one up here, the first one, because that's what you're going to see most often if you're working in VB.NET. All right. And just one last, I think we talked about this already, but just to reiterate, there is this new directory called AppCode. It's a specially named directory that needs to be at the root of your site, of your application, your virtual directory. And you can put any source code you want to in here, and it's compiled as part of the request processing, and it will implicitly be referenced by all pages in your site. So again, it's a very useful place to drop code for like utility classes or local data layers or business logic perhaps, as long as those aren't being shared across multiple sites, it's a good place for them. All right, so that's our session today. So we started off with a quick look at a whole bunch of features in ASP.NET 2.0 through the context of a sample application called Movie Reviews. You'll be able to download all of the demos, including that movie review site, from the following location. If you just go to pluralsight.com/frit/webcasts.aspx, that's where you'll find all of the demos for today's session, and actually for the next three sessions. Just keep that URL around, and you'll see all the content there. Also associated with these sessions are a lab for each one. And if you go to that site right now, you'll be able to download the full set of labs for the VB.NET version of all four of these sessions. So a good follow-up to this session would be to download those labs and install and start working on the first lab. And that'll go through a lot of the features we talked about today. I also recommend you take a look at that movie review site, sort of poke around, you know, get a feel for some of those features, and try out anything you'd like to there. So all that will be available, all of that, the labs are available right now if you just go there. And if you want to, in the next half an hour or so, as soon as we finish up with questions, I will zip up all of the demos that I did here, including that site, the movie review site, and make it available for download as well. All right, and the lab for this one, if you do choose to do this, is to create a simple ASPX file that displays some weather forecast information. And then you're going to write a utility class and deploy it in the app code directory. And then you're going to rewrite that file using CodeBehind. So sort of split this stuff up across multiple files, as you saw in the samples today. And also just walking through that sample movie review site, which we'll refer to in future sessions as well. All right, with that, I'll turn it back over to Dave, and I'll start looking at the questions that have accumulated and begin getting answers ready.
Excellent. Thanks, Fritz. We'll begin our question and answer session in just a moment. Once again, you can ask a question by typing it into the field next to the Ask button, and then click Ask. As mentioned earlier, we'll be providing a survey for today's event in just a moment. Please take a few moments to complete the survey. The feedback and comments you provide ultimately allow us to create better webcasts for you. Again, your feedback is greatly appreciated. And of course, when you fill out the survey, you'll automatically be entered into a drawing to win a 40-gigabyte Creative Zen MP3 player. I'm going to go ahead and put that survey live now. If you could go ahead and follow the links that correspond with how you registered for today's webcast. And again, your feedback is greatly appreciated. Fritz, I see many questions in queue.
Sounds good. We'll go ahead and get started. Good. I was just typing one answer. Someone asked a question about the difference in language, C# and VB.NET. We're offering these sessions in both. Specifically, he asked, can you briefly go over language comparison and your choice for development and why? To be honest with you, choosing between C# and VB.NET for web development is really a matter of personal preference and or integration with other code in your company or whatever project you're working on. I personally tend to do most of my stuff in C# just because a lot of the consulting I do ends up being in C#, but there's really nothing you can do in C# that you can't do in VB.NET, or very few things, put it that way, especially when you're dealing with ASP.NET web development. So it's really a matter of what's most convenient for you, what you're most comfortable with, and probably primarily what other people are using that you have to work with. Let's see. Someone says, I find it much easier to work with code on the page itself instead of the code behind. Why is it a bad idea not to use code behind? Or why is it a bad idea not to use? Is there any performance or security hit? You know, it's actually interesting. There really is no disadvantage to not using code behind. That is, there's no real advantage to using code behind except for the fact that you're putting them in separate files. And you're quite right. A lot of people don't really see that as an advantage. I think the advantage for a lot of people to having that separated is that you can hand the ASPX file over to a designer, and you guarantee that they won't touch your code, right? That's perhaps the biggest motivation. But besides that, there's absolutely no performance difference, no security difference, no difference, you know, very, very few other differences. So if you're most comfortable with working on the page itself, that's a perfectly reasonable way to go. Let's see. Someone says, I've developed a site with 2005 Beta 2 and need to upgrade to release. What are some of the issues? Oh, it's been so long since I've dealt with Beta 2. What I would recommend is going to www.asp.net, and I recall either looking in the online forums and asking there or looking in the archives there, but I also recall seeing a document that listed the changes from Beta 2 to release. You can probably find that there somewhere, but I forget exactly where. Let's see. Someone has a question about master pages. Is there a code behind for the master page? Yes, there is. You can have one, absolutely. And are any functions of the master inherited by child pages? Yeah, good question. We're going to explore this more in a later session, but the short answer is there's no inheritance going on. Master pages are actually, they actually turn into child controls of a page, and then they just inject the content into a placeholder control inside the master page. So if you want to share functions, you can do so. Well, we'll have examples of doing it later, so let me put it that way to be quick. But there's a master property on the page class that you can access. So you could say, you know, this page.master.some function if you wanted to call it that way. Question about how do themes and skins compare to CSS? Yeah, good question. They're really just here's the way I think of it. I think of skins as server-side CSS for ASP.NET. Right? Skins are basically a way of describing a bunch of style settings that you want to apply to server-side controls, whereas CSS is a way of describing a bunch of style settings, typically style, that you apply to client-side HTML elements. Right? So skins are all about server-side properties, and CSS is all about client-side HTML properties. That's the best way to think of it. And they're pretty much compatible. Right? You want to use CSS in conjunction with skins. In fact, you very might be using CSS classes in your skin style properties. Someone asked, can I have 2005 installed along with VisualStudio.NET 2003 without interference? In all my experience, yes. Obviously, you know, be careful, but from what I've seen, they work fine together and shouldn't be much of an issue. Question, can you do all the stuff that I did in the demos today using GUI tools, or do you have to do it by hand? Absolutely. Everything I did today you can do just with drag and drop from the toolbar. I just was trying to focus on exactly what had to be in place. But we'll do more demos as these sessions go on, and we'll certainly be using a lot of those tools. Let's see, Keith has a question. I noticed there are server-side processing directives throughout some of the pages. Will Visual Studio allow you to switch the design view with those in place? Yes, you can, absolutely. They've really fixed a lot of the designer stuff in this release in 2005. So anytime you have interspersed server-side script, it'll work okay in design view. I don't think it'll let you edit it, but you can certainly at least add other things around it. Let's see, what, if any, is the support for websites using both VB.NET and C Sharp? It's actually quite feasible nowadays. It's on a per page basis at this point. So you could have VB.NET pages and C Sharp pages in your site, and they would be compiled into separate assemblies, but ASP.NET would deal with them fine. In fact, you can actually put VB.NET code and C Sharp code in that app code directory if you create separate subdirectories and designate them as distinct assemblies in the configuration file. So it's pretty easy to do, much easier than it ever has been. Question, is it possible to nest master pages? The answer is yes, and you do so just by using a master page file attribute in the master directive of the master page. So just like you do it for a page, you do the same thing for the master page. Let's see, one of the questions I run into designing for cross-browser compatibility. The design view doesn't help much with this. The cross-browser features in this release of ASP.NET are quite a bit better than they have been in the past. Things like all of the validation controls work across multiple browsers now, whereas before they were restricted to IE, so there's a lot of good news there. The other thing they've added is the ability to create browser files. So if you're familiar with browser caps, either in the configuration files in ASP.NET or in the INI file in ASP, you can actually create separate files for each browser you expect to hit your site and describe its configuration pretty precisely. And then you can actually annotate your server-side controls with browser-specific features. So it's pretty flexible. There's some good examples of how to deal with some of that stuff on the site that I mentioned earlier, the www.asp.net. What is the name of the script file that regenerates the correct install for ASP.NET? It's called ASP.NET_regiis.exe, and you just do a -i to install all the scripts. Is IIS required on a development machine with 2.0? Actually, no, not specifically. I would certainly encourage it if you're doing any real style development. But in general, you don't have to have it because you can use the development server to do all your local testing. Let's see, Visual Studio 2005, start showing Windows application templates or file new. I'm not sure I've run into that, so I don't have a quick answer for you. Okay, I'll take a couple more questions here and then wrap the rest up, answer them through the text interface. Question from Dave, will you be doing all the examples using inline code or use code behind pages as well? I'll actually probably end up using a mixture of both, so we'll be able to see both. All right, I'll keep the rest of these questions up right here and just type some answers in for you, and turn it back over to Dave to finish out the session, and look forward to seeing you all next time.
Thanks, Fritz. I'd like to extend a special thank you today to Fritz Onion for presenting. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's MSDN webcast. Thanks for joining us. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of the session. Fritz will remain online for a while longer to answer any of the remaining questions that are in the queue. Thanks again for attending.